From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Fifty years ago today, Mort Saul premiered at the San Francisco nightclub The Hungry Eye, and a new kind of comedy was born, comedy based on the headlines of the day, not one-liners. Saul became so popular he was on the cover of Time magazine in 1960, the first comic to be given that honor. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate the anniversary with Mort Saul, who is still getting laughs from his take on the headlines. And book critic Maureen Carrigan tells us what's on her 10 best list. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is investigating a possible case of mad cow disease in Washington state. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The case was picked up through routine testing of a cow that arrived at a slaughterhouse near Yakima, Washington, unable to walk. While Europe has struggled with mad cow disease, and there have been cases in Canada and Japan, the U.S. has yet to have a confirmed case. The USDA's lab in Ames, Iowa, ran tests on material from the suspect cow. Samples are now being sent to a lab in England for confirmation, which is expected to take about 3 to 5 days. The USDA felt confident enough in its testing to make the announcement today. Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman said there's no reason to think that the presumptive infection is the result of terrorism, and she says that there's no significant risk in eating American beef. She plans to serve it at her Christmas dinner. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
The jury in the capital murder trial of convicted sniper Lee Boyd Malvo has recommended a sentence of life in prison without parole, NPR's Ann Hawk reports.
After almost 9 hours of deliberation, the jury of 8 women and 4 men rejected the death penalty for the 18-year-old defendant. Instead, they recommended a life sentence and imposed a $200,000 fine. Last week, they found Malvo guilty for the killing of FBI analyst Linda Franklin outside a hardware store in Virginia in October of last year. The jury based its decision on 2 findings, that Malvo might be a danger in the future and that his crimes were vile and inhuman. But weighing these against his background and upbringing, jurors decided against the death penalty. Outside the court, prosecutor Robert Horan said Malvo's defense team did a good job, that Malvo benefited from his youth, and the fact that the jury deliberated during Christmas week. Defense attorney Craig Cooley said he was relieved but will appeal the guilty conviction. Ann Hawk, NPR News, Chesapeake, Virginia.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said today that he disagrees with a federal judge's ruling that says members of the military services must give their consent before receiving an anthrax vaccination. Air Force General Richard Myers told reporters he believes the vaccinations are important to protect U.S. troops. Myers said the anthrax vaccine being administered to U.S. troops has been around for 40 years and has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The judge said he agreed with plaintiffs who say the vaccine is being used for unapproved purposes. So far, the shots have been given to more than 900,000 service members. The Pentagon says hundreds of servicemen and women have been disciplined or discharged for refusing the vaccine. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 3 points to close at 10,341. The Nasdaq was up 19 to close at 1974. This is NPR News. Former Illinois Governor George Ryan pleaded not guilty today to federal corruption charges. He said he'll fight a 22-count indictment that accuses him of conspiracy, mail fraud, tax fraud, and racketeering. Ryan, a Republican, said the federal government has been attacking him for almost 6 years with an intrusive and overbearing investigation. Ryan is the 66th person to be charged in a corruption investigation that covers his years as Illinois Secretary of State as well as governor. So far, 59 of those people have been convicted. In Iraq, gunmen killed a chief investigative judge in the northern city of Mosul. The killing extends a wave of attacks in recent weeks on officials working under Iraq's U.S. occupation authority. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Baghdad.
Mosul police say that Judge Yosef Koshy was shot 6 times in the back and died immediately. The slaying is especially sensitive as U.S. authorities begin to train judges who would assist a newly announced Iraqi tribunal to try members of the former regime. Stepped-up sweeps for fugitives continued. The U.S. military says it hopes to close in on former Saddam deputy Issat Ibrahim al-Duri after capturing 3 of his associates. Al-Duri is believed to be helping direct the insurgency, which has killed over 200 U.S. troops since Washington declared major combat operations over. Coalition authorities also announced new hazardous duty pay for all Iraqi security forces. Low salaries had led hundreds of new army recruits to walk off the job. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Baghdad.
In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 3 points today to close at 1,096. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders, books, music, movies, and the imagination behind them. At Borders, it's the original thought that counts. Location information at BordersStores.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 50 years ago today, Mort Saul gave his first performance at the San Francisco nightclub, The Hungry Eye. And a new kind of comedy was born, topical and conversational. As the critic Francis Davis wrote, quote, Saul was the most innovative comedian to gain access to a mass audience in the comedy happy 50s. Lenny Bruce was still doing shtick when Saul began walking on stage with a newspaper, extemporaneously riffing on the headlines. A cool jazz buff, Saul derived from musicians not only his timing, but also their habit of traveling light. Schnooky dialects and comic personas like the ones Bruce was still hiding behind would have been excess baggage for Saul, who spoke to audiences in his natural voice, unquote. Saul was the first comic to make a live recording, the first to do college concerts, to speak at the National Press Club, or to be on the cover of Time magazine. Most of today's political and topical comics owe something to Mort Saul. He's still getting laughs from his take on the news. Before we meet him, let's listen to an excerpt of his album A Way of Life, recorded in 1960, the same year he was on the cover of Time.
I want to read you part of the San Francisco Chronicle, which I have here. And there's a couple of interesting things happen you might be interested in, having to do with Billy Graham, who called me an atheist. Do you know about this? Yeah, he called me an atheist, which is not true. And as I've pointed out in the past, very few people are really atheists, you know. And Billy Graham, it's just that I'm of another faith than Billy Graham. And almost everybody is, I find, upon inspection. So, Zen Buddhism. So, the club is supposed to be empty. The owners were worried because of this high holiday. So, did I tell you about that? That's what I kept saying. So, it has to do with ethnic groups, which I want to discuss after a while, right? So, anyway, now, so I get back to that. So, this gets better. So, then he said I'm an atheist, and I pointed out I'm not, and the most people past college age are not really atheists because it's too hard to be in society, for one thing, and because you don't get any days off. That's been my big thing. If you're an agnostic, you don't know whether you get them off or not. That's it. Monday. This is really weird. So then he attacked me, and Billy Graham is in Melbourne, Australia, saving Melbourne. That's his big thing, is save cities. And I don't doubt that. It's the sincerity involved. It's just, you know, if you really wanted a challenge, you could go to Vegas. Wouldn't that be great? thank you. So now, to get back to
Mort Saul told me that 50 years ago, he started to click with his audience when he took an anti-authority position.
The blacklist was on then. Not that it isn't on now. And it was the Russians were provoking us, you know, at every turn in Berlin and all. And I pointed out to the audience that every time the Russians threw an American in jail, we would throw an American in jail to show them they can't get away with it. And I found the oppressed majority, as Adlai Stevenson pointed out, which were the Democrats who were all around and thought that it was the conformist 50s and they weren't welcome. But a lot of this sounds innocuous now, you know, like General Motors might become resentful and cut the government off without a cent. See, there wasn't a Ralph Nader then, and there weren't any kids, you know. And everybody remembers what they wanted to. People remembered the political stuff. Woody Allen, whom I saw Sunday, said to me he remembered all the stuff about men and women. I used to get up and, quote Shaw, who said a woman who demands her equality, renounces her superiority, and a lot of Freud. And so it was, don't be ashamed to be intellectually curious. That's what it was about.
So before you performed at the Hungry Eye, had you performed anyplace else before?
Yeah, in Los Angeles. I was trying to get started for about 2 years, very unsuccessfully.
What were you doing before when you were in L.A.?
Oh, imitations of movie stars and anti-authoritarian stuff about people and policemen, mostly about being a misfit in society, which, of course, makes you everybody. So there was no success here. The city was unconscious. May still be.
Were you doing,
as far as
were you doing James Cagney impressions like every other comic?
No. It was way out stuff, you know, the cadence of political people and the president, and also the sense of what they said, more than an impression. I mean, in the sense, well, let me give you an example. Here was Johnson, later I did this, expanding the war, and the way he would do it, as he established a draft and a democracy, he said, you know, it would be wonderful if the world was at peace. It would be wonderful if other countries wanted peace as much as we do. Unfortunately, they don't. Therefore, I'm sending a truck to pick up your brother in the morning. That was basically what, you know. So it was kind of looking in and saying, where are we and does anybody else feel this way? Which is what a real performer ought to do. Does anybody else feel this way? I had the misfortune of seeing Al Franken in New York, which was presented to me as political satire, and instead of taking a swing at the mighty, he's basically lifting his leg on them. And that shows you how the franchise has degenerated. I kicked the door down hoping somebody would follow me, and we're living in a day and age where Michael Moore and Madonna are endorsing General Clark. How would you approach that as a joke? It would mean basically, and I doubt the comedians can do this, today, that they see it. That's you know what Howard Dean said yesterday, that Saddam Hussein got a physical examination, and very few Americans can get one. That joke is, you know, or why weren't the weapons of mass destruction in the rat hole with Saddam Hussein? Who gave Saddam Hussein the poison gas? We did, and we've got the receipts to prove it. But you've got to have politics to do that. I had very radical parents. Jack Kennedy had parents that talked about politics at the dinner table. It's like that, you know?
Now, you're Jewish, but growing up on the West Coast, you didn't have any contact, direct contact with, say, the Borscht Belt, you know, the Catskill
Not
Mountains.
At all.
Yeah. So,
not at all.
So were you removed, you know, like a lot of children of, a lot of Jewish children in the 50s and 60s grew up with parents who knew all the dialect comics, like Myron Cohn. You know, who talk half in Yiddish and half in English. And I think that shaped a lot of Jewish comics. Were you exposed to any of those dialect comics?
No. I never had an orthodox taste. You should forgive the expression. But I spent a lot of my years around jazz. Mm-hmm. And Stan Kenton was like a father to me. I never liked the standard stuff. I like big bands. I like jazz composers that liked Hindemith as an outside influence. I liked Stan Getz. I didn't like the blues. I didn't like Dixieland music. And it was the same with the comedians. I wanted them to give the audience some credit for being bright. And it is. The audience will never let you down. It'll keep you honest.
Now, your parents moved briefly from Los Angeles to Montreal. You were born in Montreal. Your father had a tobacco shop there. Then the family left Montreal, moved back to L.A. What did your father do after the tobacco shop?
Well, he was always a writer, you know, with varying degrees of acceptance. But my father was really kind of a giant guy. I mean, he believed in honor. I mean, he was a moral leader for me. And he kept on writing. He also had other skills. He was a court reporter for the federal government, and he had a he thought character was everything, and he certainly impressed it on me. And he was not a materialist. My dad married my mother by putting an ad in Poetry magazine.
You're kidding.
That said, oh, yeah. She read it in Montreal. It said, is there still a woman out there who would like to meet a dreamer? And there was. And she came to Los Angeles on the train, and they were married in 72 hours. So they were, there's a lot here about parents that people ought to think about. You know, that whole generation I grew up with had a lot of left-wing parents, and I mean that in the kindest way. They were very humanistic, Eastern European derivation, but not great at relating to one kid at a time. It's like when I met Joan Baez, she told me she loved all of mankind, but not one at a time.
Is that how you felt about your parents, that they didn't relate to you very well, even though they were great
idealists?
No,
I didn't mean them as examples. They were terrific.
My guest is comedian Mort Saul. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Mort Saul is my guest. Now, you've made it really clear, and it's always been clear, that you've had a strong streak of anti-authoritarianism, just being
yes.
anti-authority in every way. Yet, when you were a kid, you tried to join the army before you were even of age to do it.
That's correct.
Why would you want to get into the army if you were so anti-authority?
Because it was World War II, and the greatest father figure of them all, FDR, said that was a worthy war. So on one level, I wanted to go get the Germans. And on another level, as a 120-pound kid, I wanted to get my wings and go meet girls. I had very healthy drives. You know, it was terrific. I liked the glamour. I liked the idea of honor. I liked all that. And we weren't crazy. We weren't lost either. And that generation probably saved America.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, for what? I mean, now it's all about the music and movies. I mean, you know, it would be great if somebody, somebody were really willing to fight for something.
So you tried to enlist when you were underage. My understanding of the story is that your mother went to the army and said, he's not old enough yet. Get him out of there.
Yeah, I went down and registered for the draft because I knew if it was coercion, they'd take me. Whereas if I volunteered, they wouldn't take me. So I registered for the draft, and then they called me, and then my mother got me out. I also had an appointment to West Point. Did you know that?
No, but wait a minute. Were you trying to get in or trying not to get in? I'm confused.
Oh, I was trying to get in. My mother was trying to get me out.
But you said you knew if you enlisted that they wouldn't be able
to get
in.
Oh, if you enlisted, they wanted to know how old you were.
Right.
So I overcame being 15 by going down and registering for the draft.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Then they think you're trying to get out of it. And that may be the end, by the way, of this great crusade in the Middle East if Bush starts drafting people. You know, the opportunity with this administration is so rich as an example. And where are the comedians? I mean, it's so rich. Diane Sawyer is sitting there the other night saying to Bush, what papers do you read? And the president says, I don't read papers. I've got people working for me that know everything. He doesn't read papers. I mean, it's like my conversation with him when he said, you've got to fight the war on terror. Are you ready to make the sacrifices? And I said, I don't know. I'm pretty exhausted from fighting communism with your father. And he said to me, well, I don't like it. It's a dirty job, but that's what you elected me to do. And of course, I was tempted to say, we didn't elect you that much, but that'll come. That opportunity will come. I knew him when he was the governor.
Well, you know, while we're on the subject, what about, say, Bill Maher, who does a lot of political comedy on television?
Well, a lot of it is profane, which is not to my taste. But you can't have an elite feeling toward the people.
Do you think he does?
Yeah, I think he does. I think the skepticism toward authority, you know, this is all said from a salon at Arianna Huffington's house with all those people, they all drive a Toyota Prius. That's the car for the pious, you know. And I don't have a feeling that that's a real rebellion. I'm being very candid with you.
Yeah, but you were connected to power, too. I mean, you worked for the Kennedy campaign writing for him. And you
yes, I did.
You knew still know a lot of very powerful people.
I also sat head-to-head with Kennedy and argued about Fidel Castro and the revolution. But what I'm saying to you is what Stanley Scheinbaum said. These people have no politics. They're basically skeptical about America. They think Southerners are ignorant. They think power necessarily corrupts. They're very elite. I've listened to Marr by the hour. When I met him, he was an announcer for Steve Allen, but I don't find any, I'm being very candid with you, I don't find any generosity of the human spirit, and I don't find a lot of talent there. We might as well be straight out. That's not Will Rogers.
Anybody you do like is working now?
Yeah, but I'll tell you, most of the people with great humor are professional men in other fields who, as a byproduct of their viewpoint, have a sense of urban irony. Example, Alexander Haig is conducting business in Russia.
Wait a minute, you think Alexander Haig's funnier than Al Franken and Bill Moore?
I'll tell you, I can give you examples.
Okay.
And you'd be hard put to give me any examples of those two guys. Not that that's your chore. But a great example. I mean, Haig said he was in Russia conducting business and how capitalism has caught on. And he said, I went into the Intercontinental Hotel in Moscow, and every car that pulled up was a Mercedes 600 driven by a Russian baby boomer with a platinum blonde 20 years old on his arm and a Rolex, and they all went in and drank apple martinis. I might as well have been in Beverly Hills, except there were no communists. That's a wonderful observation. You remember when I said to him, how can you he smokes Cuban cigars. I said, how can you smoke Fidel Castro cigars? He said, well, in my place, I prefer to think of it as burning his crops to the ground.
Wait, now let me ask you. I don't know if you politically agree with Al Haig and with the Republican administrations that he worked with. Do you have to agree
of
politically?
Of course not.
So it's funny to you whether you agree with the person or not politically.
Yeah, because he's a man with a sense of irony. You know, I can give you an example on the other side. Gene McCarthy has the best Democratic sense of humor. The great, great humorist, poet, and thinker. And those are the people that I honor and I aspire to know. But this other stuff of rebellion by the pound, I mean, what is it? Dennis Miller is telling you how wonderful Bush is. That's not political satire.
No, I'm gonna stand up for Bill Moore and Al Franken, who I think really are funny.
Well, until you hear the real thing, you will stand up for them. But eventually,
okay.
You know, you won't. They're not serving. I haven't said this publicly before, but I'm glad you gave me the opportunity. They're not serving the people. A political satirist's job is to draw blood. And I'm not saying that they were paid off. I think those who can do. The rest of this is emergency stuff.
What are some of the things that you said over the years that you think drew the most blood?
Oh, my God. You know, when Kennedy was nominated, I introduced him. And I sent a wire to his father saying, you haven't lost a son, you've gained a country. You know, that kind of, but something that reflects the truth, not only the truth you find, but the truth of our fathers, and something that shows a sense of history. You know, when Jack Kennedy went to Vienna and he met, he'd only been in office 2 months, and he met Khrushchev. And he looked at this medal on his chest and he said, what is that? He said, I won the Lenin Peace Prize. And Kennedy said, let's hope you get to keep it. We aspire to be like that. I mean, you know, and that doesn't mean I worship them. I had plenty of arguments with them. But those guys could give you 15 rounds. It was something, you know. It was something to know them. It was, you know, if you look at the speech by by Kennedy at American University the month before he was murdered. That's something that should be taught in the schools.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier, which is how you tried to get into the Army during World War II, but you were underage,
yeah.
And your mother kind of came and told the Army and got you out.
She did.
Was it embarrassing when that happened?
Well, it was the shooting down of a dream. I really had the glamour then. And once I got in and I saw that there were privileges and that the officers manipulated people, that's when I decided I didn't want to be an officer. I had a chance. So that there's a...
When you got in when you were older?
Well, not much older, yeah. Uh-huh. I went in at 18. Mm-hmm. But and I was up in the Aleutian Islands. So the point was that I had seen it all, but I didn't want every young man to get killed because it once appealed to me. I had the source of... I think what we're talking about here, even when we talk straight and the role of comedy, is that I'm not a liberal. I'm a radical. The liberals, they made liberalism into a way station for people that want to cooperate with a right-wing administration and not lose their source of income and still be self-righteous, you know. Have a dinner party at Barbara Streisand's, but spend an equal amount of time with the guests and out in the kitchen talking to the Nicaraguans. That's really what's going on here. And you have to find a way to kid that, see? I'll give you an example, Terry.
Sure.
Without, I don't mean to postulate, but an example of a big joke on the stage is going to a party at Streisand's, a fundraiser for a Democrat, and a star will walk up to me and he'll say, I'm going to work for Gebhardt. I don't know if he can win, but when I look in the mirror in the morning to shave this mug, I've got to know I did the right thing. They always talk about conscience. Republicans never do. And, you know, because liberals are ashamed of what they've accumulated and they don't think they have a right to it. And conservatives love everything they have stolen. They're proud of it. So... Then another star will come up to me and say, I'm working for John Kerry and et cetera, because I've got to look at this mug in the morning. So finally Norman Lear comes up to me and he says, I'm working for Al Sharpton. I know he hasn't got a prayer in a racist nation, but do you understand why I would engage in a feudal campaign? I said, does this have anything to do with when you're shaving? Because I've heard about that from my deal. Well, that's it, see? And the other thing in the technique, comedically, Terry, is to do Candide, not to stand up there and tear them to pieces. It's not Al Franken saying that the president is a moron, a liar, and a thief, as I heard him say the other night. I was on a show with him in New York. But to say you accept them and then show that the emperor has no clothes, that's your job. And you should know how to do your job.
Mort Saul will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Broken Music, a memoir by Sting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with comic Mort Saul, and book critic Maureen Carrigan runs down her list of the best books of the year. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comedian Mort Saul. Today is the 50th anniversary of his debut at the San Francisco nightclub The Hungry Eye, the club where he first became known for a new kind of comedy. He got his laughs from talking about the headlines, not from one-liners. Joseph Kennedy, JFK's father, asked you to write for John Kennedy's presidential campaign.
That's right.
And you agreed to do it. Uh-huh. What did you write for him that he used?
Oh, I can give you some examples.
Good.
It was a lot of trouble about being a Catholic then. You're not old enough to remember that. But that was a bad word to run for high office. So I gave him, they come in and they say, are you going to take your orders from the Pope? And he says, it's not the hereafter that's bothering me, but November 4th is driving me out of my mind. And when he went out there at the press conference and May Craig from the Portland Maine paper said, what are you doing for women? And he said, not enough, I'm sure. Which is, he had the quality to do it, though. You know, he had the moral authority. And he would say, and he and I used to argue all the time because I was a friend of Adlai Stevenson.
Are there things you wrote for Kennedy that he didn't use that you remember and wish he had used?
Yeah. I did a lot of stuff about Eisenhower for him. Playing golf. I said Eisenhower had hired Stevenson to write a foreign policy speech, which is true, but he couldn't use it because the language barrier was in English. And he said, I can't say that about him. And William O. Douglas, remember Justice Douglas?
Uh-huh.
Douglas was there. He said to Kennedy, listen, if you're going to be Stan Kenton. Don't try and be Lawrence Welk. He's better at it. That's all true, you know? Who could come up with that? There was great stuff. Yeah, I was, you can tell a lot about the guys about which humor they'll use and which that they get. The really heavyweight guys are never offended.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Richard Nixon said to me, you got a chance to be Will Rogers, but you have to remember to keep a blowtorch under my behind as well as Jack Kennedy's. Even-handed.
Wait, you already had the blowtorch under his behind.
Well, he was drinking at the time.
Oh.
So, but he's the smartest guy I ever met in the office, by the way.
Oh, yeah? Did you write
brilliant.
For him, too? Would you?
No, I did not. But I worked for Reagan, who was a personal friend of mine.
So whether you agree with somebody's politics or not, if you like them personally, you'll write for them?
Yeah, you'd do some jokes. At least Reagan had a sense of humor. This guy has no sense of humor unless what he's doing now
is an example. President Bush?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He has no sense of humor. I think he knows it, too. I gave him a gag. He asked me when he was governor of Texas if he should allow prayer by the student body at the football games. And I said, it depends how far behind you are. And he wasn't sure.
I see.
Yeah. His father has a great sense of humor, uh-huh. by the way. The old man said to me at the White House, he asked me when I got my invitation to come to a dinner there. Mm-hmm. And I told him it had taken 4 weeks for the letter to get to California. And he said, that's absurd. And I said, how are you going to get these guys in line? Are you going to fire everybody in the post office? He said, no, I'm going to keep them on, but I'm going to mail them their checks. He's very intellectual, but he doesn't want that out, you know. So is Estes Kefauver.
Are you writing for candidates now?
No, not currently. I worked for Bill Bradley. I wrote some stuff for him. I found him... pretty cautious.
In terms of what kind of humor he'd use?
He's aloof. Well, he's aloof in general.
Uh-huh.
The most memorable things Gore has said is since he left office.
What strikes you as most memorable?
The speech about the Patriot Act, what it's costing America. But if I were writing for somebody now, as an example, you'd say, you're writing for a Democrat now, you'd say, John Ashcroft's first act in his office was to come in and cover up the bare breasts of justice out in the hall. And that's the last time Justice exposed herself in the Bush administration. That's what I would say. And then you're off. You're off to the races. It's not a good sign that that they don't have any humor. And on the other hand, the other night at this, I was at a dinner in New York, and Lieberman was there, and he quoted an old gag of mine, which has reworked Mark Twain. You know that if you're drowning 20 feet from shore, Kissinger will throw you a 15-foot rope, and Nixon will point out that they met you more than halfway. That's the, you know, you can trot out a lot of the old stuff. You know, you remember when Twain argues with his wife and she says, "You'll never amount to anything." He said, "Well, I can always be a bad example to others." That's great American humor. That's not mean-spirited. That's not a comedian getting up and saying that the president is mindless. I mean, look at an example here. You're talking to me about Al Franken and Bill Maher and all that. What have they ever said about Cheney? I mean, wouldn't it be possible, without being intellectual, to say that Cheney is the only one covered by Bush's health plan? Or that when he dated Lynn Cheney, whom he dated, you know, in 1952 at the University of Wyoming, that he haltingly and shyly says to her, "If you're free Friday, would you like to meet me at a secret underground undisclosed location?" But you've got to have a point of view to do it. Otherwise, you're stealing the money. You've either got wit, or you can identify with the human heart, or you're Jackie Gleason, that you can do something. I mean, look, you know, you don't have to be an intellectual. You look back, of course you've seen The Honeymooners, Terry,
sure,
right?
Sure, yes.
Well, look at that. That's built as well as Shakespeare. He's always got a scheme. Nobody believes in it. His wife is the first to tell him he's crazy. When he falls on his face, who comes in there and picks him up, dusts him off, and kisses him? His wife. Why do we like it? It's about something. And when somebody says to you, "That's too intellectual for me," it means they don't want to work through the fact that they're stealing the money. They're not up to it.
My guest is comedian Mort Saul. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comedian Mort Saul. I want to get back to something we were talking about, which is that you think a comic should draw blood and should be willing to take risks.
If he does politics.
Yeah, if he does politics. Now, the biggest risk that you took and the biggest consequences that you suffered as a result of it was after Kennedy's assassination, when you were convinced, and you're probably still convinced, that it wasn't just Lee Harvey Oswald as a lone assassin. You were very opposed to the Warren Commission report, saying that it was a lone assassin. And you even went down to New Orleans for a while to work with the DA there, Jim Garrison.
That's right. I was an investigator in the office.
And you were trying to uncover if there was any CIA involvement in a plot against Kennedy. Correct me if I'm wrong on any of this.
No.
Yeah. So, and then you started talking about it almost obsessively in your performances, even reading the Warren Commission report, long passages of it during performances.
Yeah.
And things started to really dry up for you about that time. Would you do it any differently if you could do it again?
No. The death of the president was the foulest event in our lives. It was the prelude to the unraveling of the country. And the irony is the people that murdered him did not abscond with the country. It's a different country now. And I did the right thing. It's laden with irony because none of his friends did it. We came, the audience should know this. What I read on the stage was for laughs. You know, I still believe in being a comedian for a living. I read passages of the Warren Report as follows. Earl Warren and Gerald Ford cross-examined the bartender at Jack Ruby's Club. And they say to him, "What did you have in there?" He said, "We had a rough crowd. We had strippers. And they did a dance called The Dirty Dog." "Describe it," Ford says. The bartender says, "I'd rather not." And Ford says, I have the presidential mandate here, and I command you to describe this dance. And the bartender says, it's called a dirty dog, and it's sickening, disgusting, and revolting if you do it right. That's what I read on the stage. I wanted people to see by their own word that this was a hoax. Or I'd say to the audience, here's a picture of Oswald being shot while he's being guarded by 24 members of the Dallas police force, or 25 if we count Ruby. It was to give the people something to think about, and also to make them think about it, not to go home and be led in communal crying by Walter Cronkite.
Now, Lenny Bruce had been reading a lot of transcripts of a trial, his own obscenity trial, on stage during his performances. Did you feel connected to him when he was doing that?
No.
Why?
No, I never bring in anything unless I can go after him and get laughs with it. In other words, to bring people's attention to it and get some laughs with it. That's the job. Lenny, don't forget Lenny was surrounded by lawyers. You know, the kind of guys that that say we can't test the law until we break it. I don't know that I believe in that. But there's no similarity. The stuff on the Warren Commission, the resistance was not from the audience. The resistance was from the people who did it, who didn't want it talked about. You know, you can go a long way, a single voice. Remember that me alone brought Jim Garrison on to Johnny Carson, where he got an hour and 45 minutes to himself. And by the way, there's a guy who had a great sense of humor himself, but it was a sense of irony, and it was based on a deep love of America. That's the finest patriot I ever met was Jim Garrison, probably the bravest man I ever met. Garrison and I planted a seed of doubt in young people. When we got through, nobody believed that report about Lee Harvey Oswald and his electric rifle. To make it my obsession, it's not my obsession, I didn't even vote for the guy.
You didn't vote for Kennedy?
No. In fact, there's a good long-winded joke about that.
Wait, seriously, you didn't vote for Kennedy?
No. And I could give you a joke about why not.
Did you vote? Did you vote for Nixon? You're not going to tell
me? It's an Australian ballot. It's an Australian ballot.
What's
worked for Perot, too, so you ought to know everything about me.
Oh.
I wrote for Perot, too.
Uh-huh.
And admire him greatly.
But you seem so close to Kennedy. That's what seems so surprising.
Well, we were close.
I'm sorry. I just have to say again, you didn't vote for Kennedy.
Well, you know, there's a joke that goes, let me tell you the joke.
Go ahead. Tell me the joke.
A guy keeps voting for people on the basis of what they promise they'll do, and they don't do it. So he becomes disenchanted. And finally he votes for Nixon. And he says, why'd you vote for Nixon? He said, well, Nixon said he'd never make peace with the communists. And the last thing he'd ever do is recognize Red China. And just before they threatened to impeach him, he recognizes Red China. So it did turn out to be the last thing he ever did. See, you can take it a long way. But you get that by talking to people like Gene McCarthy, and you know. The great thing about McCarthy and Jack and everything is that that's the last time they enlisted young people in the cause of saving this country.
Do you vote?
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Depends who it is.
Right.
It depends who it is. When there's a promise of a new tomorrow, like Governor Schwarzenegger, you know, you can bring back the old jokes about him, too, you know?
Yeah, what did you think about Schwarzenegger?
Well, I loved the inaugural speech, but it was more powerful than the original German. Isn't that the joke? By the way, good jokes come from unlikely people. At the Reform Convention, Pat Buchanan, when he accepted the nomination, a Republican ran up to him and he said, you've divorced the Republican Party. And Pat said, yeah, and they can have the kid. And also Perot, you know, what do you think about gun control? He said, when I grew up in Texas, every kid had a gun. He just didn't bring it to school.
Right.
It's wonderful.
I imagine you still read a lot of newspapers.
As many as I can find.
And what about TV? Do you watch a lot of the cable news shows?
Yeah, I have a satellite dish, and I watch everything.
Watch everything.
That's gone down like everything else, see? Bitchery has replaced satire, bitchery and jealousy.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, you know, talking about the first lady's dress or reducing the fascism to gossip. It's the same. That's what's happened to news. I mean, who's doing news? I mean, Diane Sawyer's walking with people and saying, well, then you lost custody of your children when you were accused of smoking medical marijuana. What kind of news is that? You know, I find the press too compliant. They won't give these guys any trouble. Have you been to Australia, Terry?
No. Why are you mentioning Australia?
Because the press is adversarial there.
Oh.
The press is extremely adversarial. I went to see a speech by Prime Minister Bob Hawke at the time, and he said, I used to drink, I'm not perfect, and I was a womanizer, but our country's turning into a banana republic, and something must be done. And a guy yelled out of the audience, why don't you start drinking again? They're not intimidated by power.
No, you're a longtime jazz listener.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel like your delivery or your timing was affected by jazz at all?
Yeah, because I could leave a theme and come back without violating the chord structure.
Uh-huh.
And I think what happens with musicians is a miracle. I think Bill Evans, the pianist, or Duke Ellington, or Sinatra, most of all, was a jazz singer. People didn't even know it at the time. But look at a man who, in this age of barbarism, single-handedly was the custodian of romance in a country this size. And he kept it alive. Did you see the movie Matchstick Men, Terry?
No, didn't see that.
Well, at the end of the picture, the man bails his life out with the help of a therapist, and he gets on with his life. He doesn't go back to his wife. He finds another girl so he won't fail at the dream. But he believes in the dream. And at the end, he's straightened himself out, and he's not a criminal anymore, and he comes home, and his house isn't empty. There's a girl there that loves him, and they start to make dinner together, and she's pregnant. He puts his ear down to her stomach to hear the heartbeat, and the music comes up, and it's Frank Sinatra singing The Summer Wind, written, of course, by Johnny Mercer. And that's the whole hope of America. If the kids hear that, they might turn the right way.
Mort Saul, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I'll see you in Philadelphia.
Hope so.
So long.
Mort Saul, 50 years ago today, he made his debut at the San Francisco nightclub, The Hungry Eye. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan picks the best books of the year. This is Fresh Air. You might want to grab a pen. Here's our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, with her list of the best books of the year.
This year in books started out sluggishly. By summer, I worried that its defining literary trend would turn out to be what I dubbed pink books, a rash of reactionary romances swathed in calamine lotion pink book jackets. Then, with the arrival of fall, crisp winds blew in a rush of smart, superbly written novels and nonfiction. Susan Choi's wonderful novel, American Woman, is set in the mid-1970s and tells the story of a young Japanese-American woman named Jenny, who's been living underground ever since she set off a bomb in protest of the Vietnam War. When Jenny is finally captured by the feds, Choi makes her readers feel a deep sadness, not for the end of Jenny's misguided violence, but rather for the death of the idealism that prompted it. Here's how Choi's narrator puts it better. The loss of Jenny's freedom, of these years of her 20s, ended up being nothing next to the loss of her confidence in the choices she'd made. Brick Lane by Monica Ali is a debut novel that rightly dazzled readers and reviewers and was shortlisted for Great Britain's Booker Prize. The immigrant story it tells is not new. A young bride from Bangladesh finds herself transplanted to a grimy London housing project via an arranged marriage. But Ali's precise language and offbeat humor are so beguiling, even the smallest details register. Take her description of a doctor's walk-in waiting room packed with poor people. An old man with a knobbly nose sat in the corner, sipping mournfully from a can of something. A large family of Africans, the color of wet river stones, with long, beautiful necks and small, sloping eyes, fanned out on the front seats. The grown-ups were silent. Their faces expressed nothing other than the ability to wait. Waiting was their profession. The high-maintenance heroines in Nell Freudenberger's commanding debut short story collection, Lucky Girls, travel in the opposite direction. Departing from the United States and Europe, they backpack their complicated lives all over the near and far east. And two terrific works of fiction that came out early this year don't deserve to be buried under the bounty of fall books. A Ship Made of Paper is the latest tale of passion by Scott Spencer, whose love stories are always out of control, but whose writing never is. Meg Wolitzer's very witty novel, The Wife, should get a nudge from the popularity of that new Julia Roberts movie, Mona Lisa Smile, since it covers some of the same 1950s terrain of women's colleges that offered majors in domesticity. In nonfiction, my nominee for Must Read Book of the Year is David Marinus's They Marched Into Sunlight, an exhaustively researched and poignant work of history that focuses on two crucial events in October 1967. Marinus's narrative alternates between the University of Wisconsin, where the student protest against campus recruitment by Dow Chemical, maker of napalm, unexpectedly turned violent, and a jungle in Vietnam, where a battalion of the 1st Infantry Division marched into an ambush by North Vietnamese troops. Marinus's colleague at the Washington Post, reporter David Vondrele, wrote a sweeping and substantive book on the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire of 1911. In Triangle, Vondrele traces out how, because of that tragedy in which 146 workers, most of them young girls, were killed, the burgeoning women's rights movement, labor movement, and progressive movement all joined forces for a remarkable time in American history, transforming the Democratic Party and clearing the way for the New Deal liberalism of Franklin Roosevelt. Other nonfiction standouts were Kathy Dobie's The Only Girl in the Car, a 1970s coming-of-age memoir that dramatizes the double standards lurking under the sexual revolution, and Laura Kipnis's Against Love, an over-the-top polemic against marriage and monogamy. In 2003, a slew of mystery novels proved to be devious vehicles for both metaphysical inquiry and informed social criticism. Acclaimed Swedish writer Henning Mankell was my find of the year. His series of novels featuring gloomy police detective Kurt Wallander are in the process of being translated into English. The Dogs of Riga is the latest, but One Step Behind is my current favorite. Neil Gordon's tightly crafted suspense novel, The Company You Keep, invokes some of the same Weather Underground history as Susan Choi's American Woman. Blacklist, the latest V.I. Warshawski novel by Sarah Paretsky, delves into the Red Scare of the 1950s and makes connections between McCarthyism and present-day threats to civil liberties in post-9/11 America. And just in time for the holidays, mystery grand dame P.D. James has returned with The Murder Room, another Adam Dalgliesh mystery. Granted, the plot frays towards the end, but James's sense of place and felt awareness of evil are as vivid here as in any of her earlier great mysteries. James is now an octogenarian, but as a stylist, she still runs rings elegantly around most of the pretenders to her throne.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Her best books of the year list, as well as her holiday gift suggestions, can be found on our website, freshair.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel. This month, Anatomy of a Scene explores the making of Girl with a Pearl Earring, premieres Sunday, December 28th at 8 p.m., This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the best rock, pop, and hip-hop, and the best movies of 2003. We'll talk with Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker and our film critic David Edelstein. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.